It's always an honour to be able to have a conversation with as lovely and as engaging a writer as Kate Grenville. Since the publication of Bearded Ladies, her first book in 1984, she's been catching at a wider and wider range of characters and places, pinning them in precise and poetic language for her readers and making those readers' worlds larger and somehow more clarified along the way. Her first novel, Lillian's Story, won the Vogel Award. Its companion, Dark Places, won the Victorian Premier's Prize. In 1999, her novel, The Idea of Perfection, delivered Kate to a glittering marquee on the banks of London's River Thames when it won the Orange Prize. I don't know what the Thames looked like or sounded like that night, and I don't know if it was that night that that river weaseled its way into Kate's imagination, but that river and its very different riverine relative, our Hawkesbury, gave her the setting for The Secret River, which won a raft of awards, including the Commonwealth Writers Prize, and was shortlisted for the Man Booker. That novel brought her back to the interpretation and invigoration of stories from Australia's history that she'd begun in 1988 with Joan Makes History, and her most recent novel, The Lieutenant, sits as a companion piece to The Secret River in many ways. We're back at the beginning of White Australia's settlement, 20-odd years before The Secret River. We're walking with a cast of characters who have very different motivations and relationships to those we shared with The Secret River's William Thornhill, as he established himself as a man of means in this strange and potential new world. This time, we're in the company of Daniel Rook, Lieutenant of the Marines, and as an ardent astronomer, meteorologist, surveyor and naturalist, a very particular kind of observer. Based on the story of the First Fleet's William Dawes, for whom Dawes Point, just down the road and holding up the southern end of the Harbour Bridge, was named, this novel tells of another very different set of interactions between the people of this place and the new British arrivals to those that we encountered on the Hawkesbury in the Secret River. Because beyond the stars and the weather and the charts and the plants, William Dawes was also known for his facility for languages, and it was wearing this hat that he began to converse with the Gadigal people. He began to compile one of the most extensive vocabularies of their rich language, and he began to befriend them. In many ways, then, The Lieutenant is a book not just about the beginnings of Sydney and those first intersections between black and white. It's also a book about words and language, a topic that's perhaps close to any writer's heart, but particularly to a writer who is as particular with words as Kate. It's a book about communication, about trust, and about optimism. It's a book about friendship and possibility. As one historian commented back in the 1920s, William Dawes was, in effect, our first conscientious objector, a man who saw very early on that things needn't be or shouldn't be so divided between black and white here. I was fortunate enough to talk with Kate about this book last September at the Brisbane Writers Festival when the book had only just been out a week. And in the intervening months, it's been very busy in the world. It's been released here, of course, and it's been captivating readers and reviewers here and overseas in the UK. It's also been praised as an epiphanous novel, aglow with empathy, and Grenville's most intellectually sophisticated yet. We're talking this morning in a space that's so close to the novel setting. Somewhere very close to here, in the first months of British settlement, a group of Gadigal folk showed a group of Englishmen where there were good figs to eat. And it's just over the ridge on the eastern side of the point that was named for William Dawes and is now renamed with its indigenous moniker, Tara, that Kate's lieutenant lives his story. So I thought I'd begin by asking Kate to read a little bit from the book where she describes that space in that time, 217 years ago, when 11 little ships brought a new empire to these shores.
Thank you very much, Ashley, and thank you, everybody, for coming. I would like to just begin by acknowledging those traditional custodians of this place, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. I think we're all very, very lucky to be here on their land doing this writing business. The small bay soon had a name, Sydney Cove. It seemed made according to a different logic from the world Rook knew. There were trees, as there were in other places, but each was stranger than the last. Some were mops, with a bare pole for a trunk and a bush of foliage 20 feet above the ground. Gnarled pink monsters twisted arthritic fingers into the sky. The squat white trees growing by the stream were padded with bark that flaked in soft sheets like paper. Red parrots sidled along branches, chattering and whistling. Could they be taught to talk, he wondered, or learn a tune, like the one old Captain Vere had in his parlour in Portsmouth? Catching one would be the first difficulty. The birds watched him sideways, cannily. Bird lime or a net? But he had no bird lime, no net, and he could whistle a tune for himself, although he had to admit that there was something about these woods of New South Wales that made a man fall silent. Even the rocks were not like any others he had seen, monstrous plates and shards piled haphazardly on each other. How might he describe them to his sister Anne? Thinking of her face, the look she had as she listened to him, her head tilted, her eyes watching him, patient while he found the words, he remembered the French pastry he had eaten with her at the tea shop in St. George's Street a few days before the fleet had sailed. Layers of pastry interleaved with layers of custard, it was somewhat along the same lines as the stony parts of this landscape. It had been impossible to eat, the custard squirting out at each mouthful. He and Anne had begun by being embarrassed, but ended by laughing at each other's efforts. My dear Anne, I find myself in a land remarkably like the pastry we had that day at Pennycook's that needed to be eaten in private. In other respects, it is a dry and stony place. He pictured her reading it in the little parlour. He hoped that it would make her smile.
Thank you. I thought that we might begin, given that we are sitting quite literally in the setting of your novel, and given that you write so evocatively and so sort of viscerally about place, if you could perhaps tell us a little bit about the attractions of writing about this piece of the world and the challenges of bringing it into being as it was more than 200 years ago.
Yes. Look, the attraction, I think, is because I'm a Sydney girl born and bred, and apart from, you know, trips away, I've always lived here. And growing up, I was always conscious that there was a parallel Sydney under the one I grew up. I went to school in North Sydney Demonstration School, and I remember very clearly being taken down on an excursion at the age of about 7 to Ball's Head, which some of you probably know. And there is there an enormous etched fish, I think from memory, done by the Aboriginal people. It's now been painted with white gloss paint, just in case you might miss this exquisite engraving. And it's got a big white municipal fence around it. But I think from a moment like that, you began to think, look, we're here, I'm here, I have my house, etc. But there were other people here before us. I have a feeling I might have always sensed that at some level. And so to find a story that actually invited me to go back and, if you like, erase the Sydney that I know, that we all know, and take it back to what it was before, was a way of belonging here in a way that I think a lot of Australians, certainly of my generation, never quite felt that we belonged here. So it was a way of burrowing in to give myself a legitimate reason, really, for being here.
Because in that description of the place being like the pastry, it is one of the really seductive things about Sydney, isn't it? That you sense that there are those layers, mm. but that the layers that have been lost in a way can poke through here and there. Mm. There are mm. bits of the harbour that are still, you know, sandstone going down into water. There are bits of the bush that are still mm. pretty bushy. There are, you know, etchings in a place as close as Ball's Head.
Yes.
There probably aren't that many big cities in the world where you can sort of time travel through those little notches and crevices, I guess.
Yeah, I think you're right about that, because the harbour, whatever excrescences we put around it, the harbour is still there. And when I first started, one of the first things I did when I was starting to think about this book was to make the walk from about here, sort of, from Circular Quay, out to Dawes Point, to where I thought the observatory mm. might have been. And out there, it's sort of grass, so you can sort of imagine. But the thing is, you can look up and down the harbour mm. and you can think, well, I no longer can see anything of Dawes here, but I can see exactly what he saw. Mm. I mean, you look out to the east and you see Bradley's Head, which is still covered with bush. And it's very easy then to imagine all the headlands covered with bush. So you're right. I don't think you could do that in London or mm. New York.
Mm. I guess too, in the sense of talking about the harbour, because the water and the sky are the same, are what he would have seen. That, and because he was so interested in observing those sorts of things, it gives you another window that, or another, I suppose, a more direct link than you often have in places.
You feel as if there's a sort of triangulation going on: doors here, me here, but the land, the actual place, connecting us. And when I began to look at the stars, I always thought with awe, what I'm seeing up there, apart from precession, it is precisely the same as William Dawes saw in 1788. Exactly the same. Well, except he probably saw it more clearly.
And no satellites, I think.
No satellites, no. But that makes you feel very close to a character, and it makes you think, okay, it's not just that I'm writing about something over there, some other. I can actually, as Peter Carey memorably puts it, find a corner of my own experience that I can extrapolate into that other experience.
Mm. I've got my own crush on Mr. Dawes, as you know.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, it's not just his work in the colony, and it's not just his advocacy of the Indigenous people and his relationships with them that draws us to him. I'm wondering what drew you to him in particular, and what made him someone you wanted to spend so much time with and imagine in that way.
Well, I came across Dawes in a book by Tim Flannery called The Birth of Sydney, in which he brought together extracts from all the people who came out with the First Fleet who'd left accounts of their time there, which are about 10 or a dozen. And one of them was William Dawes. And I knew that there was this man called Dawes who had written down a lot of the Gadigal language and left them in notebooks. But Tim Flannery, clever man that he is, picked the eyes out of the notebooks and put together a couple of pages of these notebooks. Now, the thing about the notebooks is that unlike all the other language stuff of that time, Dawes's notebooks are not all lists of words. What he did was to write down entire conversations between him and the Gadigal people, and particularly between himself and a young girl called Pachigarang, who was seems to have been his teacher. So what Tim Flannery quoted were these conversations, and they are extraordinary conversations. They would be extraordinary, I think, in any context. They're playful, they're affectionate. These are two people who really like each other and who, although they share so few words, they're actually able to have jokes. I mean, you can see that they're actually having jokes with each other. And that relationship is so astonishing. No novelist would dare to invent a relationship of that intimacy without being sexual between a young soldier and a much younger Gadigal girl in 1788. Who would dare to invent that? And yet here it was, and the conversations were right there. You wouldn't dare to invent those either. So the thing that got me going about those was, who were these two remarkable people? Both of them must have been extraordinary, open-minded, curious, intelligent, and with that kind of quicksilver delight in life, that joie de vivre, they must have both had that. So I thought, okay, who are these two people who were able to have that conversation? Then when I went and did a bit of research about Dawes, and one can only do a bit of research about Dawes because so little is known about him, but the other big thing that we do know about him, or one of the other big things, is that, as Ashley said, he was the colony's first conscientious objector when he was sent out on an expedition whose task was not just to kill six Aboriginal men in retaliation for the spearing of a white man, but they were issued with hatchets and canvas bags, and they were supposed to cut off the heads of the Aboriginal men and bring them back the heads in bags. Something about that detail is particularly horrifying. And Dawes, I don't want to kind of spoil the story, but Dawes was plunged into a moral dilemma such as most of us would never have to deal with. And his answer to it, I thought, was extremely interesting and intriguing. And it brought up that whole question of how should one behave? How can one act morally rather than out of self-interest? So those two things, the characters and this extraordinary story, thought that this is a story I have to tell.
There must be a particular range of joys and a particular set of challenges in imagining the characters of those men who came with the First Fleet. As you say, there are few accounts, and there were quite only a few men in a in a sense. It was a tiny number of people, only 1,000, and you know, most of those people have disappeared into obscurity. What were the sort of the good things and the bad things about trying to give them new lives?
Well, the good thing is that there are those gaps. I mean, what a novelist needs is a great idea and then a lot of gaps. because we're not historians. I mean, historians, their job is to sort of find as much stuff, to make as few gaps as possible so that they can then do their invention. I'm sorry, that their interpretation. What am I saying? Thank you, Mr. Freud.
Well, we'll just erase that one. Where that part.
Yeah, so gaps are a godsend. So I knew just enough about doors, but not too much. That was the good thing. The other thing is that I knew this place like the back of my hand. I knew the harbour. You know, I'd spent my youth messing around in small sinking boats on the harbour. My first raft was actually made out of 4-gallon kerosene tins. It doesn't work. It might have worked for Huckleberry Finn, but I assure you it doesn't.
Something about Sydney Harbour.
The difficult thing, of course, I'm putting off replying to that because that is the hard part, and it's probably why I had to write 30 drafts, and I still haven't got it right. I mean, they were men, they were 200 years ago, they came from that unimaginable world of the officer class in Britain. They came from a time in which slavery was taken for granted. They knew that slave was essential to their economy as electricity supply is to us. It's really hard to get your head around that. But a few of them left accounts that were helpful. Dawes's notebooks, of course, but also his friend Watkin Tench, well, maybe his friend Watkin Tench, wrote the one book that isn't kind of starchy and purely informative about those times. Tench was a novelist, really, Monquet. So he wrote a very lively and personal account of it, so I could use that. And of course, the more I researched, the more I felt I could... novelists have to be cheeky. I mean, otherwise we wouldn't do a thing if we were too cautious. And I did a lot of research about astronomy, I went to Portsmouth, I went to the Greenwich Observatory. I did what I could, and then I thought, okay, well, now I just have to sit down and hope that the cosmos will give me some ideas.
And it did.
Yes. I mean, there were good things. I mean, it's funny how one little tiny bit of information in the research... For example, I found out that Dawes's father was a clerk of works in the Department of Ordnance in Portsmouth. So that told me that he wasn't from a very wealthy family. Mm. Whatever a clerk of works was, it wasn't top of the tree socially. But I also knew, of course, that Dawes had a splendid education, which included Latin and Greek and all the rest of it. So suddenly you could construct the possibility that he was a scholarship boy. With all the interesting psychological foot in both camps that must be involved in being a boy from a poor home that suddenly plunged into this much posher world.
Of course, the other thing that must have presented its own enjoyments and challenges was thinking about the intersection between the Gadigal people and the fleet and the settlers. Mm-hmm. It's a very different intersection to the relationship in the Secret River. What were the kind of things that were enjoyable and challenging about that? And was it a conscious thing to think, I want to be able to tell a different story about that interaction after the sort of shocking central interaction in the earlier novel?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think one of the reasons I leapt on the Dawes notebooks was that they suggested a kind of mirror image of the world of the Secret River, a yin to its yang, or whichever way around that should be. The Secret River is a book set 30 or 40 years later, when the project in the colony was to settle. So the main character in The Secret River is an ex-convict who takes up 100 acres of land and then fights for it, basically, against the indigenous people to whom it had belonged for 60,000 years. So it's a book about how Well, it's a book about the fight for the same resource, the piece of land. And it's quite a dark book because that was a dark period of our history. Mm. The Lieutenant is set very much earlier in that those very first couple of years when the project of this colony was to be a penal colony. There was an idea that, you know, there might be some good land out there, but in the first instance, it seemed as if it was really only a matter of supporting the people who were there. There wasn't that sense of, we want to take over this whole place. So in other words, the relationship between black and white in those first years was actually one of much more curiosity. I mean, in the other accounts of the First Fleet that we have, there's a great deal of curiosity, and although it's a very mixed story, there were violent scenes on both sides, but there was also a great deal of mutual curiosity and friendliness. Wat Kentinch, for example, seems to have had quite a real relationship with Bennelong, who came and lived in the settlement, etc. So it was a much more cheerful thing. And of course, what the Dawes manuscripts show is that in those early days, before the battle for land started, it was possible to have a true conversation across the barrier of race. And in a way, that conversation stopped when settlement started to push out and has only just resumed, it seemed to me. Even the necessity for a conversation. You know, last year, Kevin Rudd made his historic apology, and I was on the lawns of Parliament House when that happened. An absolutely amazing moment. I mean, we were all in tears standing on that grass. And I thought, what Rudd is saying is, it is time, after 200 years of closing down the conversation, it's time to try and have that conversation again. And I thought, yes. And I'm writing about a man who had that conversation 200 years ago.
Did it make it a more... Was the time of doing that, or the sort of the timeliness of doing that, did it drive the novel as well, of thinking... I know when you spoke about the impetus for the Secret River, I can remember you talking about walking across the bridge on the first day. Was the apology and sort of feeling that conversation starting to have a voice again, did that make it more imperative, I guess, to tell the story of this friendship now?
It wasn't the initiator, but it was the encourager, because by coincidence, February of 08, I was just about to give up this book. I just thought, it's too hard. I cannot do it. I'm, you know, writers are supposed to write about what they know. My lines of supply are much too thin, you know. I'm Napoleon in Moscow writing this book. What I was writing seemed thin and unconvincing to me. I also was deeply worried, actually, about trying to step into that relationship, you know, writing about... I mean, this book is not... The Aboriginal point of view is never there. It's all Dawes's point of view, Rook's point of view. But I did feel as if I was treading a very fine line there about, you know, telling somebody else's story. So I was feeling extremely disheartened. It seemed really dead. I mean, most books go through that period. You probably... There's a moment at which you think, no, this is the one I'm going to have to put in the bottom drawer. So standing on that lawn, it was like the cosmos saying, no, keep trying, yeah. You know, keep going, even if it's not brilliant. It's something. Somebody else can do another book about Dawes, as in fact you are doing next year. You know, there are a lot of books to be written about this period and this time, and this is just one of them. So...
It's, I think, the other fascinating relationship in the book, beyond the relationship between Rook and Tagarin, or Dawes and Pattier, is the language. You know, he is transcribing her words and transcribing her world, in a sense. Mm. And it's a confronting thing as a writer to put yourself into Dawes' position and imagine coming to a place, the landscape is not just alien, but you have no way into that language. It sounded so that, you know, the sounds were very... strange and harsh. There were sort of sounds that occurred in English that weren't used at all in those words. And you described it beautifully by saying that for someone like Dawes, it must be like being a child again, being unable to give things their name. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the power of discovering the language that he left in the notebooks that he left, and then about how the language and the words became so central to the novel itself.
Yes, without words, you can't really get to first base. I was in Darwin just after the cyclone in 1975, and I remember driving from the airport into the city, and I don't know whether any of you were there at that time, but I still can't think of words for it. And the thing is, we were driving past these streets full of stuff. There was no name that you could give to any of it. Occasionally you'd see something you could give a name to. Oh, a car in a tree. And that was kind of reassuring. But most of the time, it was like the beginning of the Big Bang. It was just kind of formless stuff. And I realised that because I couldn't give names to what I was seeing, I could actually no longer feel. I drove past in a kind of numbness, and it made me aware, vividly aware, of how if you don't have words for something, you can't get to first base with it. You can't think about it or feel it or see it. And that must have been the position that Dawes was in trying to learn the Gadigal language. I can't imagine how they began. I mean, it's easy to imagine you hold up a hand or say your name or something, but beyond that, I found it really impossible to imagine, and I could only admire him. The notebooks are wonderful because they start, as a linguist would probably do, with very tidy alphabetical lists, which he was obviously intending to fill with vocabulary. Each page has a little, you know, letter of the alphabet on the top. And the second notebook is full of empty verb paradigms. I eat, thou eatst, he, she, or it eats. And he was clearly just going to fill in the blanks. That was his idea of language. And as you flip through these notebooks, you can see all that falling away. You can see the man of science, the astronomer, the scholar of languages, realising that he's got to chuck all that away and just plunge headlong into the river of what's happening around him. And that's where the conversations start to happen. It's almost as if he's saying, I've just got to get this down, I'll worry later about what it means. And what a shift in consciousness that must have been for him.
Well, particularly in a time when communication was so much more, there were levels of it that were so much more formal and precise. You know, there was the way that orders were given, there was the language of those sort of very official dispatches, there was the language among the officers, which would have been quite different to the language among other groups of people. Mm. It must have been an even bigger step, perhaps, than we would take now.
Yes, that's right. And where, I suppose the only thing is that at the end of the 18th century, the idea of writing down languages, unknown languages, was starting to be, it was part of the whole Enlightenment project. And in fact, the Dawes notebooks have survived because they're in a gigantic collection in a museum in London called the Marsden Collection, which is full of mostly missionaries who went round the Pacific, you know, writing down the words of these languages. So there was that, but none of them... I mean, it seemed to me that William Dawes discovered a different self in... I mean, they say, with every language learned, one gains a soul, and there's no question that Dawes gained his soul by learning what he learned of Gadigal.
It fascinated me to think, because Dawes, of course, leaves in 1791 and then has this fascinating life where he's the governor of Sierra Leone and he's back in England for some time and he ends up in Antigua. Mm-hmm. He's very involved in campaigning against slavery. And I always wondered whether he kept thinking in the Gadigal language, whether some of those words stuck with him. There are some beautiful, beautiful words in there, words that have no... direct translation into English. Mm-hmm. And I love the idea of this Englishman going off and doing quite extraordinary other things, but just with these other sounds. Mm-hmm. And if a word sort of snuck into his conversation every so often, quite naturally, because he had such extensive conversations with these people that it must have become habitual, in a sense, for him to speak in their language.
And what a lovely idea that, you know, for the rest of his life he would actually use. At the end of this novel, I've got him remembering one of the words that leaps out of the notebook. It's a word, putua, in Gadigal. And the English translation is to warm one's hands at the fire and then to rub gently the fingers of another person. All that huge rigmarole in English. One very beautiful putua in Gadigal. And one could imagine... I mean, that's a classic case of a language presenting you not just with a new word, but a new idea.
Mm.
And for a language to have a word for that consoling, affectionate action says volumes about the culture that that language, you know, created. Mm. So I like to think of him remembering that sort of thing.
Yeah, I like to think of this book bringing that word back into usage, because I think it is a perfect word, and you know, as you say, it takes you three sentences to get through it in English. I think we need to.
What a great idea!
Everybody needs to go out and use it four times today in casual conversation, if they could.
You'll need a fire, of course. I might say that I was hugely helped. Several people are studying Dawes's notebook, several linguists, and I was hugely helped by them. Some of them have actually been able to detect where Dawes made mistakes, because they have a 21st century understanding of linguistics. And that makes it still very living. Those notebooks are still being dealt with as a living resource. So I'm very grateful to those researchers.
Because there is a process to put the notebooks online, isn't there?
I think it is now online. Yes.
Yeah.
I haven't actually checked, but the museum in London that owns them has this project, Dawes Online, where you can go and look at not the smeary microfilm that is all you can look at here, but beautiful, proper facsimiles. Mm. So I must have a look.
So everyone can develop their own crushes on Mr. Dawes.
You can all write your own books, yes.
I know you've spoken in the past about keeping your own notebooks in which you store those little things that flash past. And I'm wondering, do those sorts of contemporary and very personal repositories, do they feed into historical work like this as well? Are there things that that kind of you can find a home for from your world back into those worlds?
It's amazing how they do. I'm thinking about... 1,000 of them, really. But one of the things that... I'm not sure it's actually in the book, but I went camping while I was writing this book to try and get my thoughts going. And I had one of those little epiphanies, and I wrote it down, and the only light I had was the light of the fire. And when I looked at what I'd written the next day, the letters were big and awkward, they're crooked, the lines kind of cross each other, and I remembered a bit in the Dawes notebooks right at the back, which are just like that.
Mm.
Most of the notebooks are very neat, but as you would know, there was one page where you can barely read it, and it's funny, big writing, and I thought, he wrote that by firelight. And again, it was that sense of, I'm suddenly really close to him. I've done that. I've written by firelight. He wrote by firelight.
Mm.
You know, I know something about this man.
Is that one of the things that you're trying to do as a novelist when you're researching, is look for bits of experience that you can have in the 21st century that give you an empathy or a different kind of level of understanding of something that happened in the 18th?
Yes,
because that's a tricky
absolutely.
Bridge to walk, isn't it?
It is. I mean, there's a lot you can do. I mean, that going and camping was terrific for the Secret River, and it was also terrific for the lieutenant. The fact that at night... You know, I mean, we have matches, so it's easy, but, you know, they didn't even have matches. So if in the middle of the night you needed light, there wasn't any. So unless there was a moon, the cycles of the moon would have been absolutely known to them. They would have planned their activities around whether there was going to be a full moon or not, because without the moon you have no light. It seems to me, I am a novelist, and this book is really about the present as much as the past. But in order to write about it in a way that's somehow honourable to the past, I always feel that I need to understand it as well as I possibly can, given that I never will really understand it. But I have to do everything I can. With The Secret River, I made slush lamps and ate, you know, cornbread and all the rest of it. With the Dawes, with the lieutenant, there's a scene at the very end of the lieutenant which takes place on the shores of Botany Bay at night, and it's the moment when Rook has to make the moral decision finally about whether he's going to join this expedition to punish the Aboriginal people or not. And I had written the scene, and I had him, you know, agonising about whether or not to do it, and I could tell that it wasn't working. So I went down there one night. I mean, this is the brilliant thing. It was, you know, half an hour's drive from where I live with my daughter. And it was so different from what I'd imagined.
Mm.
And I realised that unless you can actually be there... So I rewrote the whole scene. I saw things that I could not have possibly invented.
Mm.
You know, we can take very little credit, I think, as novelists for for having good... Well, I take very little credit for having good imaginations. I actually think I make very little up. The world provides it.
It's an act of translation or of presentation rather than...
Yeah.
Because I can remember you talking... I can't remember if it was when we spoke in Brisbane or somewhere else, but about when you went to Portsmouth and you realised that there was a similarity between what you can see from Dawes Point and the sort of the shape of somewhere in that would have been in his landscape in at home. And again, that's something you'd like to make up as a novelist, but it has a different resonance when you can actually see those translations there.
And it might not occur to you. Yes, there's a place. Portsmouth is some of you probably know Portsmouth. It's got a very narrow neck to an enormous harbour. And when you sit on that neck where there's a very ancient Henry VIII or something fort and look across to the other side, I sat there, you know, thinking, oh, well, Portsmouth, ho-hum. What? And then I suddenly thought, I've sat on Dawes Point looking across to Luna Park and it's really just like this in a funny way. So, again, it kind of gives you the feeling that you have the right. It's all the sleight of hand. That's the sleight of hand of authority.
So you're constantly looking for permission to...
I am, actually, yes. Mm, yeah.
To go in and tell the story.
Yeah. Well, you know, when you base or when you allow yourself to be inspired by real stories, as I very often am in my books, there is a bit of a moral dilemma. I mean, you are taking over somebody's life and telling it, hopefully, so vividly that their life is going to actually be almost replaced, perhaps, by the story that you're telling about it. So that's a big responsibility.
Mm.
And I feel that very, very keenly. When I wrote Lillian's Story, which was my very first novel, which is based on a very well-known, I realise now, Sydney eccentric called B. Miles. At the time, I thought I was the only person who knew about B. Miles. How stupid can you be? And I wrote that book very... innocently, you know, stupidly, actually, not having thought out those ethical dilemmas. Now I'm very keenly aware of them.
Mm. Was it different too? I know in Searching in The Secret River, William Thornhill is inspired by Solomon Wiseman, who was an ancestor of yours. Mm-hmm. Dawes is a kind of ancestor of Sydney, I guess. He belongs to us in that way. But was that sense of the kind of moral implications and the duty you had to serve these men well, was it different in the sense of a family member and Dawes as the not family member, I guess?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, it shouldn't be, but it was.
Mm.
I felt this man, you know, this man's blood flows in my veins. I have a right here. I still want to be fair, you know, to him and as truthful as I can be, given the limitations of the historical knowledge. But, yeah, there was... I suppose it's part of that sleight of hand of giving yourself permission when actually nobody can give you permission to tell somebody else's story.
Mm. I want to come back to something that we talked a little bit about already, but it's the limited resources about the beginning of Sydney and you know the limited number of people who come, the limited number of words that they leave themselves. Mm-hmm. And given that it is so scanty, those sort of snippets and fragments, is there something seductive about all the space around that? Or is that where you're looking for more and more permission of thinking, well, you know, can I do this because I don't know that? Or is it something that makes it lovely to wade in and begin to play in that way?
Yeah, for me it made it easier, the fact that there was so little. And the other thing is that such sources as there are all have to be taken with a grain of salt, every single one of them. I mean, I suppose the Dawes notebooks, least of all, but all the other things were written to be read by other people. You know, the documents that the governor produced for his bosses back home, and all the people, including especially Tench, who wrote with publication in mind. I mean, Tench had a publisher's contract before he left England. So, you know, we're not going to believe a word he says. So... there are not only gaps in the record, but you've also got to think, what was in it for him to write this that particular way? You know, as a writer, you know how you can, just by the choice of one word, it's very interesting, in the intentious description of the expedition with the hatchets and the bags, he describes it all quite starchily, and then he says, finally at dawn, this terrific procession set off. Now that one word slants his whole thing in such a way that historians and many, many other people have used that word to say Tench really didn't want to do it either. He was just going through the motions. The fact that the expedition was a failure was kind of on purpose, etc. So one can so easily push it one way or the other. Mm. So that adds another dimension to that. Not only are there gaps, but not only what do they know, but are they telling the truth?
Yeah.
And the answer is no, they're probably not.
Of course, William Dawes did leave a lot of other papers. Mm-hmm. There's that... I don't know what the word is. It's that sort of heartbreaking story which belongs to a lot of people in history, where there was a fabulous archive and a lot of the papers were destroyed in a hurricane, and a lot of the papers were destroyed by his family, who clearly thought it's just old stuff, we can get rid of it. Did you fantasise about being able to turn up those other... There must have been journals and letters. Or did you fantasise about what might have been in there, if anyone... would go to Antigua and dig around?
I did. Actually, be fantastic to go there. I'd love an excuse to go there and dig around, because I think one could probably dig up a little bit more, not a huge amount. And, of course, in England at this moment, there may well be. I mean, the notebooks themselves only came to light fairly recently. I think it was... I think she was a Mitchell librarian. Phyllis Mander Jones dug around and was responsible for them emerging from the Marsden collection, which is an undigestible collection, but somehow she found them. The letters that Dawes wrote to Neville Maskelyne, which are one of the other resources we have, I think have also surfaced fairly recently.
Yes.
So probably there's still a fair bit of stuff over in England. There may in fact be, any day now, somebody may emerge blinking from the archive saying, I've found Dawes's journal.
And you're all wrong.
That's right.
Go back and try again. Yeah. There was one overseas review of the book by the novelist Lionel Shriver that really interested me, because she wrote, I felt quite dismissively about our chronic Aboriginal guilt and our retroactive hand-wringing. It just struck me that was there perhaps a simplicity in the way that people beyond Australia look at these threads of our history compared to the more complex ways that people like you are trying to plumb and inhabit those stories and make a different sort of sense of them.
That's so interesting. I wonder if it's... Lionel Shriver, I think, is American, isn't she?
Is she? Yeah.
Whereas the British reviews, I mean, her review was very praising, but yes, it did say, you know, for once, here's an Australian writer not indulging in this breastbeating. Whereas the British do seem to understand that nuance. I mean, the British only a year or two ago had the year which was the memorialising the abolition of slavery.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
And a huge sense of responsibility and retrospective hand-wringing, all the stuff that, in fact, we're doing, about the Indigenous people and how badly we've treated them. So I think a nation that has allowed that dark kind of... It's like a dark tide to come up through the floorboards of their nice history understands that it is infinitely complicated. And, in fact, the word guilt is simply not the right word. It's a very coarse word. I suppose we don't have a better one. It's a wonderful moment to be an Australian writer interested in history, in fact, because for the first time in 200 years, I think we're all hungry to find out what happened, first of all, which the historians are, you know, brilliantly doing. I couldn't have written either of these books without the work that the historians have done and the insights they bring to all that. But to make it nuanced, you know, those people were not villains, they were not heroes, they were ordinary people like us, fumbling their way through their lives.
We might take some questions from the audience now if anyone would like to ask Kate anything. Again, there are microphones, I think, on either side here. If you could make your way down to them and see a little bit of movement.
They could shout and we could repeat the questions.
Yes, if anyone would...
There's a person,
a brave
person.
Someone's achieved
the
microphone.
Hello. Hi, Kate. There's a character in the novel who, by the end of it, has become quite unlikable, and it's the best friend of the main character who represents a writer. Was it an intentional thing to be quite severe, perhaps, on his motivations as a writer and living that experience, in order to fictionalise it or to write about it, as opposed to Dawes, who sort of lived the experience for its own sake? Was that intentional, or perhaps some guilt that you had?
My dear, everything is intentional. It's a really good question. The character in that you mention is called Talbot Silk in the book, but as anybody who's read anything about the First Fleet would know, it's really Wat Contench. And I, in fact, quote a couple of sentences from Wat Contench's account of his years in New South Wales. He was another officer of Marines, and he's always described as a friend of Dawes. But when I looked very closely, I actually found no evidence of him being a friend of Dawes. And in fact, when Dawes, at the end of his life, appealed for some money from the British government and asked Tench to back him up in his appeal, Tench didn't back him up. So that put me on the thread of thinking, wow, we read Tench's book, which is charming. He comes across as such a likeable guy. And we think, oh, what a wonderful man. Suddenly I read it through different eyes, and it made me start to think about the basis on which we make up our minds from history. I mean, history leaves us these random little bits, among them Tench's wonderful book. And what we make of them might be true or might not be true, but it's very much like what I'm doing in writing a novel. I mean, Tench was, in fact, quite a considerable novelist, I think. And I wanted really to... I mean, part of what I hope this book would be about, although I don't really think it is how do we know what we know? So this is a novel which I have said is inspired by William Dawes, but that's all it is, inspired. I made it up, basically. Don't believe me either, you know. Think it out yourselves. Go and do the work.
Are there any other questions? Yeah, there's some over here.
Yes, I would like to know if you have thought about a third book, about a trilogy type of book on the McGibbon-Foote style.
A trilogy?
Yes.
Well, funny you should mention that.
Just taken my concluding paragraph on rewrite the end.
Well, as it happens, yes. At the end of... I mean, there are a lot of gaps in Australian history, and they're rapidly being filled, which is terrific. One of them, of course, is the whole area of Indigenous, you know, our shared history, white and black. Another is the convicts, the voices of the convicts, which have been silent for so long. But the voice that still seems to be utterly silent in Australian history is the voice of women, not gentrified women, but women like my great-great-grandmother, the daughter of Solomon Wiseman, who was an illiterate, rural, working-class woman, who went, on her marriage in 1830, went to what was then the extreme frontier of the settlement, to a little place called Currabubula, which is near Tamworth. I mentioned the name in case any of you happen to have some letters or diaries. Or little blue notebooks.
You can contact Kate after the session.
Please do. So, yeah, I want to try and do what may be impossible, to tell a story about those illiterate women who left nothing behind apart from their dates of birth and death and the dates of their children.
Does that take you back, in a sense, to what you were doing in Joan Makes History?
Oh, yes.
Which is a sort of a very different historical novel, in a sense, of imagining women in sort of important points of Australia's past.
Yes, that's right. I wrote Joan Makes History wanting to say, let us... You know, Australian history always foregrounds the men. The women are invisible. Let's reverse it. Let's foreground the women. So it was a kind of a joke, but it's obviously stayed with me.
Mm.
So, yeah, watch this space.
I think there's one more question here, and then we might need
I've
to...
I've actually got two questions. In light of the storm, the backlash from historians over the Secret River, my first question is, did that inform your writing in any way of The Lieutenant? Did it, you know, were there any sort of areas that you were particularly sort of careful about? And also reflecting on all of that, you know, what are your thoughts about the role of of the fiction writer in terms of telling history?
Well, I'm a fiction writer, I'm not a historian, and the whole kerfuffle, which was only two historians, was in fact based on a misreading of, not to be rude about journalists, but I was interviewed on the phone by a journalist who doesn't take shorthand, who then wrote an article paraphrasing me. So it was that article that has been used as the basis and an image that I used in a radio thing. So really, it was a beat-up, basically. I have never claimed to be writing history, which is what they complained about. So when I was writing The Lieutenant, what I was sad about and angry about was that what The Secret River was really about seemed to me an important issue. What does it mean to be a white Australian who is descended from that first lot of people who displaced the Indigenous people? That seemed a discussion I was hoping would happen. But unfortunately, because of those two historians, all discussion was monopolised by this thing of, you know, how dare Kate Grenville write about history? And to some extent, the same thing has happened with The Lieutenant. Who cares whether it's history or fiction or what label you put on it? Does it tell us something useful about today? I'm not particularly interested in reconstructing the past. I'm interested in where we are now. So, you know, if the book somehow illuminates the puzzle that we have now as the legacy of being a colonising force, if it illuminates that, that's enough. That's done its job.
Thank you. I wanted to... I wanted to finish with one question of my own. When Dawes came here and built his observatory and he was supposed to be looking for a comet that, of course, never came, so he, you know, kept busy with lots of other things, including the vocabularies. But one of the things he did was he was roped into mapping out the plans for the city that Governor Phillip envisaged building here, very grand compared to what they had. Mm. And I wonder if you thought about what he'd make of the place that we made, which doesn't have his fabulous wide boulevards and the Cathedral by the Quay and all those sorts of things. What do you think he'd think about our Sydney?
Oh, I think he'd be disappointed. I mean, wouldn't he? When I was writing this book or researching it, I kept trying to kind of erase Sydney from the landscape and see how it was. And I'd go around to places like Elkington Park in Balmain, which I think is probably a bit like what Dawes Point was like when Dawes was there. I think he'd be disappointed because we have turned our back, really, on this most glorious natural resource that we have, the harbour, in so many ways. I mean, why didn't we knock down the Kyle Expressway? Why did we ever build the Kyle Expressway to block it off? What a sacrilege. We've been given this exquisite place and we really haven't done much with it. Out on Dawes Point, nothing remains of his observatory except the archaeologist very kindly showed me the sort of step of solid rock where they think it probably was because he built it against the stone so that the instruments didn't wobble. You know, it's all part of the Great Australian Forgetting. You throw it out, you bitumen it over, you build a toast rack on top of it. Such a shame.
That brings us to the end of our time with Kate this morning and with her Lieutenant Daniel Rook. Thank you all for coming along to the session. In particular, thank you to Kate for her time, her words this morning and always her written words. She'll be signing copies of the book in the Ruth Cracknell Room after the session if you'd like to catch up with her there. In an interview given around the time of The Secret River's release, she did talk about it being perhaps the first in a series of interlocking historical novels. The Lieutenant is the next link in the chain. And yes, we're waiting to see where we go next. Her novels, as one reviewer has put it, always deliver their readers into versions of the past that feel so fresh as to be newly minted. But I just wanted to finish with a very nice quote from Patrick White, who said of Kate's first novel, Lillian's Story, that she had transformed an Australian myth into a dazzling fiction of universal appeal. In the stories that she tells us of our places and their times, I think she's been doing that ever since, and for that we should be very thankful. Thank you.